This weekend starts right after this.
Did you know that right now Geico is offering an extra 15% credit on car, motorcycle, and RV policies? That's 15% on top of what Geico could already save you. So what are you waiting for? Save an extra 15% when you switch by October 7th. Visit geico.com to learn more.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This morning with your host, Gordon Deal.
The politics of coronavirus. Jennifer Kashinka in for Gordon Deal. Thanks for joining us this weekend. Coming up this hour, the coronavirus belongs to no political party, but the response to it is increasingly split between Democrats and Republicans. As we continue to work from home, at least one tech expert thinks we need some tweaks that would merge the best features of laptops and smartphones. What teachers are weighing as they decide whether to return to the classroom this fall, and why it seems like bullies are everywhere.
Psychologists say bullies tend to have four personality traits. And these would be Machiavellianism, which is a tendency to manipulate others, a psychopathy, a lack of empathy and willingness. That's what psychopathy is. Sadism is when people take pleasure from inflicting pain. And then one of the big ones, narcissism, and that's an obsession with self.
Elizabeth Bernstein of the Wall Street Journal will be here in just a few minutes with that story. The coronavirus knows no party affiliation, but the response to the pandemic is increasingly splitting along party lines. Valerie Richardson of the Washington Times has examined this split and joins us now. Valerie, it seems that in the very early days of the pandemic, we were pretty united in our response and reaction. What's happened?
And I think that people still, to a certain extent, are united on things like, you know, it's advisable to wear masks, it's advisable to socially distance. But what you're seeing right now is a big push between what you could call team shutdown and team reopen. In other words, as cases rise in the Sun Belt, you're seeing a big push by Democrats to have a new wave of shutdowns, basically, in those states and in other states where we're also seeing cases rising. And whereas Republicans are doing everything they can to keep the economy open. And so that's what the conflict is playing out right now.
There was a lot of focus in Michigan months back when Gretchen Whitmer shut down things and there were protesters who came to the state capitol. Are we still seeing that kind or more or less of those protests now?
No, I think it's moved right now to the political arena where you're seeing less of it on the, like you say, less of what we saw in Lansing, Michigan, and more of the back and forth between Republican and Democratic legislators, Republican and Democratic members of Congress, governors. Basically, what's happening is Republican governors who are resisting the shutdown measures, such as Texas Governor Greg Abbott and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, are getting a lot of heat from Democrats saying you've got to shut down, you've got to have a statewide mask rule. Meanwhile, you're still seeing kind of what you saw with Michigan with Democrats, where they are when they're reinstating or expanding or elongating their shutdown rules, they're getting a lot of pushback, primarily from Republican state legislators. We saw yesterday in Pennsylvania the Republicans' House passed a measure basically that would curtail Governor Tom the governor's power authority to enact the executive orders and emergency orders that he used to, you know, put the shutdown in place. And a lot of legislators on the Republican side were very upset about that during all that was going on, including in Michigan there, and in Wisconsin as well. We've seen a lot of legislative pushback on that, some court fights, that kind of thing. And so we've really got it going on both sides.
We're speaking with Valerie Richardson of the Washington Times. Valerie, are the parties manipulating and or just using certain points of data to make their points?
Well, you know, that would be a shock, wouldn't it? if people manipulated the science to promote their point of view. But, you know, I think you see that happening with just about, you know, any debate. You've got factoids on both sides that can be used to bolster your debate. I mean, one thing that the Republicans are pointing to is that even though case counts are really surging, the number of positive cases that you see, particularly in the Sun Belt, the death rate is not following suit. It really dropped dramatically at one point, and it's ticking up a little bit now. But it's pretty much, you know, it's not doing what it was doing in the early days in, say, New York, where the death rate was, you know, a much larger percentage of what it is now. I mean, one thing that's interesting is that we see Andrew Cuomo pretty much taking what you might call a victory lap right now. New York, you know, beat the coronavirus, et cetera, going on Jimmy Fallon, and he put out this poster sort of, you know, promoting the state's response, and yet New York still has the largest number of deaths in the nation, despite what we've seen going on in Florida, Texas, et cetera, and it's not even particularly close. New York's they have 32,000 deaths from coronavirus recorded. The next closest is California with 7,000. They had 165 deaths per 100,000 people. Next closest is New Jersey with 170. New Jersey's got more with 175, although they got fewer deaths. And a lot of that is just how do you count the cases, who gets counted, that kind of thing. There is some manipulation of statistics that can be done there, because obviously if you test more, you get more cases. You're going to see a surge in cases, but I think what people on the other side are going to argue is, and also the hospitalization rate. Are hospitals getting too full? And you've got examples on both sides there too. Some hospitals that are in places like Texas and Florida that are really at capacity, and some that are not. So there's plenty of information to bolster both sides of the argument.
Thanks, Valerie. Valerie Richardson of the Washington Times. It's 12 minutes past the hour.
For streaming, creating, gaming, and more, power your passions for less during Dell's exceptional cyber savings event. Enjoy up to $400 off stunning laptops like the XPS, along with high-performance desktops and next-level Alienware systems, redefining what's possible with 10th-gen Intel Core processors. Shop special prices on top-brand electronics and accessories, plus enjoy free shipping on everything. Don't forget to ask for Intel when you call 800-BUY-DELL. That's 800-BUY-DELL.
Jennifer Kashinka in for Gordon Deal. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Bullies have been around for a long time, but during a pandemic, when there's constant fear and anxiety fueling anger, it seems worse than ever. With some tips on how to deal with bullies, Elizabeth Bernstein of the Wall Street Journal. Elizabeth, what are some of the personality traits that bullies have in common?
Psychologists say bullies tend to have four personality traits. These would be Machiavellianism, which is a tendency to manipulate others very calculatedly, psychopathy, a lack of empathy and willingness, that's what psychopathy is. Sadism is when people take pleasure from inflicting pain. And then one of the big ones, narcissism, and that's an obsession with self.
Your article talks a lot about narcissism. What is it about that makes someone bullyish?
You know, narcissists believe that they are better than others. They're very grandiose. But often narcissists have a fragile side, and they're vulnerable. They actually are sort of babies themselves. So this mix of I think I'm better than you, but I'm quite insecure, can trigger them. When they feel that they're attacked, they want to attack somebody who they think is weaker than them. But if that person stands up, they just keep going because now you've triggered them.
What about this pandemic has brought out the worst in people?
Well, as you mentioned, fear and anxiety really fuel anger, and I think that many, many people are living with some level of fear, and anxiety is a huge one. Also, we've moved a lot more of our interactions online. Psychologists have known for a long time that when we do that, when our interactions are online, people show less empathy and they're more likely to sort of misbehave. We can't even read simple cues like facial expressions. And then the public discourse in this country is quite antagonistic right now, and that's fueling things.
And also on social media, people can be anonymous, which makes them even worse bullies.
Exactly.
We're speaking with Elizabeth Bernstein of the Wall Street Journal. Elizabeth, your story begins with your own personal anecdote of being bullied on the road. Talk about that.
Well, I drive this little VW Bug, and I drive it in Florida where there's a lot of pickup trucks. And I was just waiting at night to make a legal left-hand turn, one that I make every day to get home. And there was just a giant truck who thought I should move into traffic a little faster than I could. I couldn't. Traffic was coming at me. I wasn't going to risk my life. But this person behind me just lost it and honking and moving up on me and trying to get me to move. And when I finally could safely make my turn, he followed me for blocks, honking and screaming out the window and swearing. He was trying to intimidate me. He was annoyed. I was in his way, even though I had the right to be. But it was just a straight-up bully tactic. That's why I wrote about it.
And how do you not react? How do you stay calm in that situation?
I think you have to remind yourself, look, this person isn't acting normally. This is not normal behavior. You have to be confident. I'm not doing anything wrong. I'm going to safely make my turn, and then I'm going to try to get out of this guy's way. But you want to remain calm. You do not want to engage with a bully. That's true if the bully's behind you in a giant pickup truck, or he lives next door, or it's a sibling, whoever at work, whoever that bully is, the key, everyone I interviewed, the expert, was clear on this. The key is you do not want to engage with a bully. If you do, that only gets that bully to come back at you harder.
That kind of stuff makes me angry for, if not minutes, hours after it happens. How do you not let that happen to you?
Well, you go back to all those skills everybody's always talking about, right? The deep breathing and the, you know, calm, and call up something fun on your phone, a picture of a kitten if it takes that, or your kid doing something awesome, or a great day where you won the game, whatever it was. But you need to sort of go to those skills that we keep being taught and told about over and over just to calm down, because it is so easy. I'm not great at that. Last week I, was furious at some driver trying to do the same. And if you engage, it's frightening. People are very activated out there right now. We have to be clear about this. People are living with who knows what kind of anxiety and fear and serious problems. And so we need to just now stay in our own lane and try to be calm, try to let it go, because it is a very stressful world.
Elizabeth, when do you know it's time to get some help if it's a really serious situation and you can't handle it yourself?
So if you ever think that you're unsafe, you want to get help. You don't want to try to handle this. If you've got somebody coming at you all the time, threatening you, there's all kinds of examples I heard when I was reporting this. So you want to go to an authority. It could be your workplace, your HR at work, if it's a workplace bully. It could be the police. It could be a lawyer. But the one thing about bullying is you don't just make a threat back, a meaningless threat for their meaningless threat or their meaningful threat. You need to have meaningful consequences when you're going after a bully.
Thank you. Elizabeth Bernstein of the Wall Street Journal. It's 21 minutes past the hour.
Let's talk about some numbers other than the stock market. Just how much could you save, for example, in 1 year by switching to Harry's? You have your choice. You could buy 26 cups of coffee in New York City, or 3 deep dish pizza dinners in Chicago, or, keeping it closer to home, 6 months of Netflix. At $2 a blade, Harry's can save you hundreds over time, but they don't skimp on quality. With Harry's, I get a smooth, close shave, and the precision trimmer blade makes it easy to get the tough spots around my goatee. Get your own Harry's trial set by going to harrys.com/Gordon. And if you love it, blade refills are delivered directly to your door on your schedule with or without a subscription. It's super convenient. Listeners of our show can redeem their Harry's trial set at harrys.com/Gordon. You'll get a weighted ergonomic handle for a firm grip, a 5-blade razor with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade, rich lathering shave gel with aloe to keep your skin hydrated, and a travel blade cover to keep your razor dry and easy to grab on the go. Go to harrys.com/Gordon to start shaving and saving today.
With employees stuck at home, combining some of the features of laptops and smartphones would be a great idea. So says tech analyst Rob Enderle. Rob, how has the function of the laptop changed in the past few months?
It's kind of our lifeline back to our companies now. A majority of people are working from home now. And the end result is they're living on their laptops. There was a huge rush to get everybody laptops. In fact, the PC market's doing great as a result. But to provision folks that they have a laptop computer, but we're discovering certainly serious shortcomings to laptops, because they were designed for the most part for people that were highly mobile. That means they were going to different places, taking their laptop on planes. And that's not the case now. Now laptops are being used for people that are not mobile. They're at home. They're working. They're given a laptop because it's a system in a box, and so you don't have to have the separate monitor and the setup problems that typically occur with a desktop computer. But they're being used more in line with how a desktop computer is used, and the end result is certain things just really aren't ideal.
What are some of the things that aren't ideal in your opinion?
Well, the big thing is for video conferencing. You know, we're living off Zoom for the most part, WebEx, Microsoft Teams, those products. And the end result is what we're finding is the laptop camera isn't ideally placed, and the laptop has a limited screen real estate. They're relatively small screens. Your desktop computers typically have 27 inches or above. My screen is 49 inches. But the laptop screen's typically, you know, 13 to 15 inches, and that's pretty small to do work and have a video conference at the same time. Plus, the camera on the top of the screen generally is well below your eye level, so it has the camera aiming up your nose, which is not an attractive view for most people. I was on a call the other day from one of the people that one of the big vendors that makes laptop computers, and they were introducing a laptop computer, and the woman doing the call refused to use the laptop because the view was so unflattering. And so with a smartphone, which also has cameras, often cameras on it that are better than on a laptop computer, if you could integrate the two, you could put the conferencing image on the phone, use the phone's camera, put it on a stand, raise it up high enough so it was at eye level, and then you'd still have your laptop screen to do your work because, you know, you need to take notes. You may be doing other things at the same time you're in the conference, and using the same screen for both things is just not ideal. Where if you could use the phone for part of the function and the laptop for the other, but have them interrelate so you could still use your keyboard to text into the phone and do things like that so that it was still an integrated experience, then it would be far better. And Microsoft and Dell have been working on applications that allow a little of this, but they all preceded the COVID-19 outbreak, and so they really haven't fully embraced the conferencing aspect of the devices. They're less integrated than would be ideal, primarily because they were developed before we had this need.
We're speaking with tech analyst Rob Enderle. Rob, what else does a phone do better than a laptop can do that we need to meld into the laptop?
Well, a phone typically is always connected, and laptops aren't right now. You do have always connected PCs, but there are laptops that have a 4G and eventually a 5G connection. But phones have those by default. And often in a call, what you'll find is your local network gets saturated and goes down. I was in a business call the other day myself, and suddenly a good chunk of my city went offline, and I was knocked off the call, and I lost the engagement. Phone uses the cellular technology, and it remained working. Even when I couldn't connect with a laptop. Now, I could have gone back in and tethered, but if it's not a seamless experience, nor is it easy. And so with a always-connected phone as a backup, if for whatever reason your network goes down or your kids suddenly start streaming videos on five screens of your house or everybody in your neighborhood, which is particularly a problem with cable connections, start streaming, and so your video image goes to heck, the phone could take over automatically, and the people viewing you would not see any disruption. You know, a lot of the events we've got going on with companies right now are virtual, and I was actually on a call with one of the big vendors, and their CTO was doing a talk to thousands of people, and suddenly his network went sideways, and it was incredibly embarrassing. This year, you have the chief technology officer for a major, you know, Fortune 50 company talking about technology, and he can't keep his network up. It just wasn't very flattering for him or his company, where if he'd had that fallback to a cellular connection, he could have kept going and we wouldn't have known he'd even had a problem.
Tech analyst Rob Enderle. It's coming up on 30 minutes past the hour on This Weekend.
Michigan is one of the best places in the country to do business, but you don't have to take our word for it. Take Evan Lyles, CEO of Roush Enterprises, instead.
For the people that are involved in product development, there couldn't be more unique and exciting opportunities that are really going to shape the future of the world. It's a really exciting time to be in Michigan.
Big things are happening in business here. Find out why by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity.
Jennifer Kashinka in for Gordon Deal. Coming up in the next half hour on This Weekend, the pros and cons of returning to the classroom in the fall. Sometimes money can buy happiness. We'll have some tips on how you can be a happier person. Another innovation during the pandemic, virtual camps and virtual babysitting, and the benefits of voyeurism. That story in about 20 minutes. Return to the classroom or not? That's the tough decision facing many teachers around the country as they weigh the benefits of salary versus the risks of COVID-19. Ryan McKinnon of the Sarasota Herald Tribune, part of the USA Today network, has spoken with some of these teachers and joins us now. Ryan, who did you speak with?
There's a bunch of teachers that are real worried about, they're basically trying to figure out what they're going to do. So I talked to a number of teachers in Sarasota and Manatee County down here in Florida. Both counties have been sort of hot spots for the virus, and there's a lot of uncertainty among teachers at all levels, not just elementary or middle school or high school, but kind of just all the way across the board.
Can you give us a specific example of someone you spoke with?
Yeah, I talked to a couple of teachers at Sarasota High School, and they had been planning on a delayed opening and doing a lot of remote learning, and they were feeling okay about that, but two of the teachers I talked to are both right near retirement, so they are about a year away from being able to receive their pension while they continue working, which the way the retirement system is here in Florida, it really incentivizes, you build up a lot of money in your very final years. So they are conflicted because they need the money for their retirement, but they don't want to catch the virus.
Will their decision to come back be based on what classrooms look like?
In a lot of ways, yes. They are sort of chuckling to themselves as they hear administrators and politicians talking about how students can help with, you know, mitigate against the spread of the virus by wearing masks and by cleaning and by, you know, following all these new rules. And they're high school teachers, and they know that, you know, they're constantly, you know, battling with kids over using their cell phones and, you know, vaping during class and all sort, you know, kids making out in the hallway. So they're just kind of shaking their heads as they hear these overly optimistic projections as to how kids can help stop the stem of the virus.
We're speaking with Ryan McKinnon of the Sarasota Herald Tribune. Ryan, are there provisions being made in Florida schools now for plexiglass or small classes or every other day, all these things being considered?
Yeah, they had considered a lot of those. Basically, the flow of information is making it really difficult because districts across the state had been putting together plans for reopening, and a lot of those included a hybrid model where kids are online at home half the time and in school half the time, so they have smaller classes. Some districts had planned delayed opening until after Labor Day just to wait and see, you know, so they can kind of make a more educated decision. But the governor, the Commissioner of Education, through the governor, issued an order that basically nullified all those preparations just this week, saying schools need to open on time. They need to be open, you know, 5 days a week. And so that really throws a wrench into a lot of their planning. So now the focus has shifted more towards things they were already going to do, but aren't seen as aggressive in trying to stop the spread of the virus, things like, you know, mandatory masks and portable plexiglass little partitions that kids have to carry around with them and different things like that. But the more drastic solutions seem to be, not, you know, it's a developing situation, but it kind of seemed like a lot of those would not be allowed.
That's Ryan McKinnon of the Sarasota Herald Tribune. It's 21 minutes before the hour.
With the recent global pandemic, the way we work together seemingly changed overnight. And if there's one thing we've learned, it's that having access to the right resources is essential for adapting your business. But when it comes to finding the right talent, the process can be time-consuming, frustrating, and expensive. Whether you're launching your first business, scaling your current business, or in need of extra support to complete a project, find the quality talent you need instantly with Fiverr. With Fiverr's online marketplace, your business is connected to freelancers offering hundreds of digital services, including graphic design, copywriting, web programming, and more. And it's so easy. You can customize your search by service, deadline, price, seller reviews, and more. Plus, no more guessing games. You'll know exactly what you're paying for up front. No negotiating needed. Check out Fiverr.com and receive 10% off your first order using my code Gordon. All the digital services you need in one place at Fiverr.com, code Gordon. Fiverr.com, code Gordon.
Jennifer Kashinka in for Gordon Deal this weekend. Well, money isn't everything, but yes, it can bring you some degree of happiness. Joining us with some tips on how to be happy is Jonathan Clements, founder of HumbleDollar.com and a former personal finance columnist at the Wall Street Journal. Jonathan, you believe it's okay to go ahead and build wealth?
Absolutely. One of the things that we know from the research is that money can buy happiness. We just have to be really thoughtful about how we use our money. If you look at any particular point in time, people who have more income, more wealth, tend to report higher levels of happiness. But the exact nature of the relationship is a little bit unclear. Is it that simply having money in the bank makes people feel happier, or is it really that the rich are actually happier? We're not entirely sure what the relationship is.
Could it be that there's a little less stress in your life?
It could be, though. Actually, one of the interesting things is if you look at day-to-day happiness, people who have higher incomes tend to report more anger and stress during the day, while people with low incomes seem to have greater sort of day-to-day happiness. The real benefit of money seems to come more from when you sit back and you think about your good fortune. And if you've got $1 million sitting in the bank, when you sit back and think about your good fortune, you're probably going to smile.
Now, Jonathan, one of your tips is basically that you don't have to keep up with the Joneses.
Yeah, one of the things that's really important is to avoid comparisons. So when the rich say, I'm happy, it's because they look around and say, wow, I'm doing so much better than everybody else. If you aren't among the super rich, you don't want to go around comparing yourself to other people because it could actually hurt your happiness. So what does this mean? You don't want to go to stores where you can barely afford to buy anything. You don't want to go to restaurants where the bill's going to be a nasty surprise. And you don't want to live in a town where you're surrounded by rich neighbors. Any of those strategies are going to tend to hurt your happiness.
We're speaking with Jonathan Clements, founder of HumbleDollar.com. Especially now, I think we're finding that we have a real reason to be happy that we are healthy, and we need to express gratitude for that and other things.
So one of the things that we know is that people feel happier when they think about the good things in their life and realize how fortunate they are. And we all have good things in our lives to be thankful for. So if you're having a day where you're feeling a little bit rough, think about the fact that you have a lovely home, that you have, you know, nice possessions, that you have this collection of friends and family who you enjoy being with. Thinking about the good things in our life can help to boost our mood. Meanwhile, if you focus on the negative, the irritations during the course of the day, you know, the people you don't like to associate with, the bad stuff that's going on at the office, that sort of thing is going to drag you down. So focus on the positive and express gratitude for it.
Jonathan, what's the importance of pursuing your passions?
So we know that people get a lot of pleasure from work, but what they want is work that is meaningful to them. So what the research says is that if we're doing stuff that we feel that we're good at, that we're passionate about, that we find challenging, but we feel that we're competent at, we're going to be happier. There's this notion in the research, it's called flow. When we have these moments of flow where we're deeply involved in work that we feel we're good at, it can be among our happiest times. One of the strange things about pursuing our passions, though, is that while pursuing them can greatly boost our happiness, actually achieving whatever our goals are is often a letdown. So we're feel much better when we're pursuing our passions than when we actually accomplish what we've set out to do.
Jonathan Clements, founder of HumbleDollar.com.
Michigan is one of the best places in the country to do business. But you don't have to take our word for it. Take Patty Poppes, president and CEO of Consumers Energy, instead.
All of the innovation that's occurring around robotics, AI, it's happening here in Michigan. We have chemical companies, we have pharmaceutical companies, we have medical device manufacturers. Michigan is a magnet for innovators and dreamers.
Big things are happening in business here. Find out why by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity.
Jennifer Kashinka in for Gordon Deal this weekend. And now we even have COVID babysitting. This morning's Jim Chesko with the story.
Virtual camps, babysitting via remote. These are actual things here in 2020. And here to talk about those and other related topics, The Wall Street Journal's family and tech columnist, Julie Jargon. All right, this has been a challenging year for so many people because of the pandemic. We know about the layoffs and other hardships, but there's also the issue of parents who need to work and have young kids and no one available to really take care of them, with many daycare centers and summer camps shut down. So what are their options?
A lot of parents, just desperate for an hour or two of time here and there to focus on work, have been turning to virtual babysitters and virtual camps to keep kids occupied.
Yeah, tell me first about the babysitting app Nano. How's that work?
That's a babysitting service that pairs people with babysitters in person. And I spoke with a babysitter who was working with a family in person for quite a while. But when the coronavirus shutdown occurred and she could no longer take care of them in person, she offered to do some phone-based babysitting with the kids just to give the parents a little bit of a break.
And I'm sure there are some pros and cons with that. I mean, the remote stuff is great for adults, for work meetings or virtual chats with old friends. But I imagine there are various issues when trying to keep kids' attention remotely.
It's very hard, especially with really young children. Like this particular babysitter, she was helping care for a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old. And she had some things planned for them. She was hoping to do a 1-hour WhatsApp video call with them twice a week. She was going to have them do worksheets and then kind of guide them through some physical activities. But the kids weren't really having it. As she found out, when someone's not there in person, they kind of lose some of their authority. The kids decided they wanted to do their little babysitting session in the backyard. So they would carry their mom's phone outside and prop it up on a chair. The phone would fall over. The babysitter would have to shout through the phone to have them set the phone back upright. And the kids got into all sorts of other precarious situations that she had little control over from the other side of the screen.
So is she trying to adapt now and, you know, make some adjustments to have things go a little more smoothly?
Well, that only lasted for a certain period of time because she actually went on to become a nurse. But the way the parents sort of adapted to that was they signed their children up for some virtual camps, like a lot of parents have been doing. And those haven't been going super smoothly either. So, for example, the 2-year-old is doing a combination tap and ballet class virtually, and they set up a little mat where the little girl could do her tap lessons so that she wouldn't be tap dancing on their hardwood floors and scuffing those up. But the little girl would sometimes run off the mat, and the parents had to kind of make sure she came back to the mat. And then their son has been taking some virtual ukulele lessons, and they said that they've had to spend a good deal of each class reminding their son to pick the ukulele and not his nose.
Now, I don't know if this is the one you're talking about, but you did talk to a woman who's running a virtual summer camp called Camp Quarren Kids, 3-hour sessions, I believe you wrote. What is involved and how is it working out for her young campers?
Yeah, so this is a recent university graduate who decided to help out some of the families that she had babysat before the pandemic, and she created a program that she called Camp Quarren Kids. It's a, you know, virtual camp where she does crafts and science experiments and yoga, and it's mostly worked pretty well.
And then there's Bundle, which I guess is available to some folks as an employee benefit. What is Bundle?
Yeah, Bundle is a service that pairs caregivers with either parents who have young children or adults who need some help with their elderly parents, and they provide online one-on-one either instruction or companionship to people, you know, totally meant to be online interaction. And I spoke with an instructor with Bundle who was working with some parents to provide some, you know, some sort of babysitting and instructional service for kids. And, you know, she too said that sometimes her best plans kind of went out the window based on what the kids wanted.
Julie Jargon of the Wall Street Journal with this morning's Jim Chesko.
For streaming, creating, gaming, and more, power your passions for less during Dell's Exceptional Cyber Savings event. Enjoy up to $400 off stunning laptops like the XPS, along with high-performance desktops and next-level Alienware systems, redefining what's possible with 10th-gen Intel Core processors. Shop special prices on top-brand electronics and accessories, plus enjoy free shipping on everything. Don't forget to ask for Intel when you call 800-BUY-DELL. That's 800-BUY-DELL.
Well, if you've been stuck inside or at home for months, you're probably pretty sick of the view from your window. Here's something that may spruce up that view, the ability to peer out of someone else's window. The website Window Swap opens up other people's windows and lets the internet peek at the view. It's become a popular respite for users from around the world who are sick of isolation. Site visitors are randomly shown views from different locales, all filmed from inside people's homes and out their windows. Footage is submitted by users all across the world. There are babbling brooks in Bavaria, sunsets in San Paulo, and rainy New York's from 20 floors up. No two views are alike, even when they're filmed in the same space. The founders of the site, a Singapore husband and wife, call it their quarantine project, designed to beat their lockdown blues. They note that it's going to be a while before we travel again and wake up to a new view outside our window. So until then, why not voyeuristically travel by looking out of somebody else's window? They say it's calming to see how other people are spending their period of isolation, if not a little jealousy-inducing. You can submit your own view, too, in 10-minute-long horizontally shot footage from your windowsill. And that'll do it for this hour. I'm Jennifer Kishinka. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.
Did you know that right now, GEICO is offering an extra 15% credit on car, motorcycle, and RV policies? That's 15% on top of what GEICO could already save you. So what are you waiting for? Save an extra 15% when you switch by October 7th. Visit GEICO.com to learn more.